Record here.
Good morning, everybody.
Shabbat Shalom.
My name is Jordash Kipiak, and we're recording these things now. The last two actually have been recorded as well, and they went up on the internet. But I requested that they not be, that someone has to contact me first to get permission. But now I'm going to go all out there and put this one out for anybody to download and read, whether I know them or don't know them. I want to say something quickly about the internet and my thoughts on private information on the internet, just because I made this decision. I don't have a Facebook account, and I feel somewhat I have mixed feelings about personal information on the internet, because I know that anybody can access it. In a meeting like this, where I can see the faces and I know who I'm talking to, I feel comfortable handing on a recording of that to friends of people that are sitting in the room. But to just let anybody, for instance, somebody in Afghanistan who I've never met, or I don't know, just pick somebody, and letting anyone get involved in a conversation that they don't know the background of the conversation, I feel strange about that. But I'm going to adjust the way that I'm presenting myself this morning as opposed to the last two Saturdays, so that anybody can download this and listen to it. That will change things a little bit, but on the other hand, and change things in a negative, it disrupts the intimacy, if you will, of a meeting like this. But on the other hand, it can be beneficial because it can reach a wider audience. And if people think that this is a meaningful type of Bible study, then anyone in any part of the world, including Afghanistan or Czechoslovakia or whatever, Czech Republic or the Slovak Republic, can download it and look at it. The last 2 weeks, we have been looking at... You tell me, what have we been looking at the last 2 weeks?
Miracles.
Yeah. Miracles, Elijah.
The response to miracles.
The response to miracles.
In contrast between Jesus and then the miracles of the Old Testament.
Thank you, Bill. That's good. I'm saying your name, so now you're on the internet, too. We looked a lot at literary features, the way that people tell the stories about, for example, the main one was the miracles that Jesus did. I'm going to take a little bit of a step back and just do this. We all want to read the Bible well. Here I am, a relatively young guy, 34. I mean, I'm more than halfway to 40, but I'm still a relatively young person, and here I am trying to give you some of my thoughts on reading the Bible. So I appreciate that there'll be people here that have lots of experience that I don't have, and they could definitely sit here and do a study and help me along. But I'm going to give you my thoughts on it. How do we get at reading the Bible well?
Get to know Hebrew.
Get to know Hebrew. Thank you very much. And Greek, I would add.
Well, first Hebrew.
Absolutely. Sure. How else do we do it?
Context. Yeah, I mean, just knowing context is helpful.
What kind of context? Give me a couple examples of...
Like land of Israel.
The geography. Okay,
yeah,
bingo.
It's important.
What else?
History.
The history.
Historical
of the period. Mm-hmm.
Knowing the author and the authors.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, if you know the Gospel of John, it's a lot easier to read and understand the epistles, John's three letters. I mean, they go hand in glove together. I would also suggest that, you know, we would let the Spirit of the Creator renew our mind and fill us with a sense of, with the ideas of justice, compassion, goodness, love. When we have these concepts filling us more, we will understand, when we read things, we'll understand that, yeah, the woman that was raped in the end of the book of Judges by a whole city, and her husband gave her, or her it really was a kind of a, she was a pilega, she was a concubine, she wasn't really even his first wife, it seems.
Pilega shmagiva.
That's right. So when he pushes her out there to be raped by these people in order to save his own skin, we should have a sense of how to understand this story and whether or not this is a good or bad action, because of how we know what God's character is like, right? I mean, these are the type of things that we learn from other places, or even within reading in the between the lines in the story itself. Lastly, and this is what we were looking at the last couple of weeks, if we want to understand the Bible better, we really need to understand the literary style of the authors. This is really a big point that, especially North Americans or Europeans, we often miss in reading the Bible. The biblical style, if I can put it in one word, is, what was the word that I picked here, is subtle. You really have to have a sense, a tam, a taste for the way that stories are told to get the point. You can read through a story and miss the entire point because it's not set in a neon flashing light. Let's talk a little bit about the biblical style. How does the biblical style, just give me adjectives or just some descriptive sentences of how you sense or how you see the biblical style when you read a, in general, just very, very general, especially let's talk about biblical narratives.
Well, two words that have been used that I had to look up in the dictionary when I first encountered them are terse and laconic.
Mm-hmm. Terse and laconic. Do you want to flesh it out a bit?
Well, it just means that there's actually a lot is told, but it's told with very, very few words. So there's a lot of gaps. There's a lot of room to think around a small skeleton of words, and that's on purpose.
Absolutely. We don't see a lot of, for example, physical description in the Hebrew Bible. Name me some people. Let's talk about people. Name me the physical description of a few people. Can you think of one or two?
Saul was tall.
Thank you. Saul was tall. That's a lot of information. That's about all we get. What else? What other people?
David
had a... was a reddish.
Yeah, ruddy face and handsome. So we get two things for him. What else do we have?
Was it Jacob's eyes who were dim?
That was Leah's eyes that were weak. Are you thinking of that? Or are you thinking of
Isaac's eyes?
Isaac's eyes were dim.
Okay, Isaac's eyes were dim. Right.
Leah's eyes are caught. Is not this...
I don't know how you translate that.
Tender.
Tender, sure.
All sure. These letters. Maybe his eyes are bad.
How about other people? Absalom.
Moses glowed.
I mean, that's about all we get from... Absalom had long hair. He was also very beautiful, and he didn't have any blemish. There wasn't a moom on his body. He had a perfect body. Now, it doesn't tell us if he was buff. It was just perfect. That means he didn't have any scars. He didn't have any... He had a perfect body. He had long hair, and he was good-looking. That's all we know. I mean, that's it. Absalom is about the fullest physical description we get of any person. With Elijah, you get the fact that he had hair and he had a belt. That's it. A hair and a belt.
Samson had hair and strength, maybe.
Samson had hair and strength. So, yes, we get the general idea that physical description is not a key characteristic.
Since you mentioned Elijah, there's so much known about Elijah, but there's one thing that people don't seem to really latch on. If you look at chapter 17, he appears on the scene out of the blue.
Mm-hmm.
No mention of him before that.
Yeah. And we'll return to that point. Actually, Elijah will be an important part of our studies. We'll return to that exact point. There's also, name me other, or give me some other things that you see in the narrative style of the Hebrew Bible, especially.
Parallelisms.
Thank you. Yes. Can you flesh that out a little bit?
We can give you examples.
Yeah.
I can give you an example where the English translation doesn't follow the Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
Psalm 110, verse 4. Nishba Adonai velo inachem, ata kohen leolam, al divrati, marki tzedek. Al divrati. And the translation is always after the order of,
mm-hmm.
when it's wrong. Al divrati can only be upon my word. And that fits with Nishba Adonai velo inachem.
Very nice. Yeah, that's nice. I haven't spent much time studying that one, so I don't have much to comment on that one.
Maybe a few lines of it.
Sure. But there are many other instances of parallelism as well. Think about in narratives especially. I'll give you one that comes to my mind. Some people wonder, Now, why does the story of Judah and Tamar in chapter 38 of Genesis come immediately in the middle of this story about Joseph? Remember what happens in chapter 37? Joseph is introduced and his dreams are introduced. This is really the beginning of the Joseph narrative. He's, you know the story, right? I mean, he's taken by his brothers, thrown into a pit, sold into slavery. They kill a goat and put blood on his cloak, bring it to his dad, says, "Do you recognize this?" And he's like, "Oh," he starts weeping for his son. And the next thing you know, we have a story about Judah getting married, having two children, them growing up, them getting married. I mean, we have a huge disparity in the time frame. We're going in 20, 30 years.
Three
children. My point is here is that it seems like a major or break in the narrative of the Joseph story.
I may suggest two aspects.
Yeah.
A, Judah is going to feature very prominently with Joseph again later on by Yigash.
Mm-hmm.
Also, if you consider that that chapter also gives us the birth of Peretz, who features again at the end of the book of Ruth and in Matthew.
Yeah, those are good points. But why there?
Why there? Yeah. And I'm going to give you some thoughts from Robert Alter. These are not my own thoughts, but I'll give you some of the thoughts that I've gleaned from him, and I think that are good on this story in particular. And feel free to interject. And I like the dialogue. That's the way. That's the style that I enjoy most. So don't feel shy to jump in and share thoughts. If you take a look at Genesis 37, and you take a look at how this wraps up, we won't spend too long here because we're actually going to look at some other texts, but just quickly look at it. Genesis 37. Let's look at where did they first start speaking to their fathers, around verse 37. Genesis 37, verse 30 to say 32 or 3. Would someone like to read that? Keith, do you want to read that?
Sure. Yep. 31, 32-ish. All right. Then they got Joseph's robe, slaughtered a goat, and dipped the robe in the blood. They took the ornamented robe back to their father and said, "We found this. Examine it or recognize it to see whether it is your son's robe." He recognized it and said, "It is my son's robe. Some ferocious animal has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces."
That's great. Now look, in the Hebrew here, they have v'ishhatu se'ir izim. They kill a goat, right? And the way that he asks him to recognize it, "Do you recognize this?" He says, "Hakel na." Which verse is that? 32, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he says, "Hakel na." Do you recognize this?
Yeah.
When we go to the next story in 38, and we have this story, you tell me what happens with Tamar. What does she do? She's a pretty active woman, and she gets what was her God-given portion because she is active, because she does something about the injustice.
Verse 25.
Yeah. So give me the details of the story. What happened?
I think Sharon did about something a while back, like
okay.
3 years ago.
Okay.
And so Tamar gets Judah's ID and his credit card, basically his staff and his signet ring. And then she does the same kind of thing that Judah and the brothers do to Jacob.
Absolutely.
She does it to him. And she takes him and says the same thing. Basically, Hakir, now you like recognize these things. Whosoever these are is who got me pregnant. Kind of thing.
Absolutely, and that Hakel Na, I believe, only appeared twice in the entire Bible.
Yeah,
and they're in this here in 37:38. It's clear if you're not used to the biblical style of telling things, you'll miss all of these details. The point is, why is the story told here? It's because the deceiver gets deceived. Mm-hmm. Think of the end of chapter 37. Jacob is weeping for Joseph. At the beginning of 38, you see one son killed, the second son killed. And no mention in the story about Judah weeping for them. He may have wept for them, but that's not the point of the story. The point of the story is that where, I mean, they're two extremes. One extreme is a father who overly loves one child and favors them, and the other story is of a father who doesn't have the kind of heart of compassion that is needed, and it's not till he is bested at his own deceptive tricks that he sort of comes to realize that the way he's been acting in the past is bad. And he becomes a good character later on in the Joseph story, but this is sort of a very important liminal episode, and it helps along the whole Joseph story, actually. That's enough about that. There are other aspects of biblical narrative style that we should mention here as we sort of try to do a list of different features in narrative style.
Could I say one thing about it? It was just interesting to me the way he came to his father and said, "Do you recognize this?" He didn't put any, he didn't say, "We found this. Joseph must have been killed," but he kind of put it out there and made Jacob come to that conclusion himself. It was kind of an insidious way of doing it. It was like, if he'd been really sad, he would have been weeping and crying and saying, "We found this, and my brother has obviously been hurt." But he just kind of, just the way he introduced it, I thought was showed his character.
Mm-hmm. And I should follow on that and say, yeah, and there's also one other connection between the two stories was that there's a goat, of course, that's used.
Mm-hmm.
Judah sends a goat to get Tamar, says, "Here's the payment." And it's the same type of thing we had in chapter 37. That's for parallelism as one example. There are other types of things in the biblical style that are very prominent that we don't really have in Western literature in general. Certainly not in recent literature. There's a lot of speech. Sometimes there's more speech than there is narration. And in fact, the speech itself carries on the story. And oftentimes in the speech, you actually have differences in detail of something that had been narrated, and you're supposed to pay attention to how the person tells the story of what just happened. Do they add something? Do they subtract something? For example, when Jezebel has... what's the fellow's name killed with the plot of land?
Which?
The Naboth. Naboth.
Naboth.
Naboth. Thank you, Naboth.
Naboth.
When he is stoned and killed, that's what the messengers tell her. But when she goes to tell her spouse Achav what happened, she says he is dead and he's not alive. She doesn't mention anything about the stoning, but you're supposed to recognize that from how the story is told, that she's concealing that information. And it's an easier pill for Ahab to swallow because he doesn't hear that from her lips.
I think the classic example of those two things is when Abraham, he just sends a servant to get the wife, and then the whole narrative is propelled by this, the retelling of the speech, but the subtle differences of how he presents what happened to the family as opposed to what happened, it's all significant.
Absolutely, and another good example of it is in 1 Kings 19, and we'll return to Elijah later, where he says, the Lord says, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And he says, "I've been zealous," and da 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 da. And then he has this appearance of all kinds of power of God, and then finally this still small voice, and God says, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And his response is word for word, verbatim, what he said in his initial response to the first question. And you should know something. If there's no difference in the response after all that he just saw or experienced, that should tell you something. We'll return to that story. But definitely, speech is a huge part of the biblical, much more than other types of literature. Another thing is you can create meaning by juxtaposing episodes. We saw that with the Tamar and Judah story. And another example of that is in Exodus 17, where they, first of all, they cross through the Dead Sea. They get the water healed at Mara, thank you. The Israelites get the manna from heaven. They get the slav, the meat, and then they complain again when there's not enough water at Massa or Meriva. They test God, saying, "Is God really with us?" And immediately after, in chapter 17, you get Amalek coming and fighting them. And the question is there: if God is really with us, okay, I will show you an event in which you can definitely know that I'm with you, because every time that Moses' hands are up, I'm there. Every time that his hands are down, I'm not there and you're losing. And the way that the story is told, even though there's no word that connects those two stories, the fact that they come one after the other builds a connection.
There you have a very interesting point in semantics also. Yedei Moshe Emunah.
Faith, faithfulness.
The thing that this is kind of a silly analogy, but if you hear there, 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 you know it's coming.
Mm-hmm.
And if you hear there, 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 you're cheating hard, or you know the genre of music. And so it's really the same here. Because it's like you said a long time ago, in a galaxy far away, you know exactly what's coming. So because we're not an oral culture, we forget that. But the Bible was written to an oral culture. Even though they're literate, a lot of them, the storytelling style tells
them
something.
Absolutely. And as we become more familiar with the literary style of these authors, we will read the Bible better. We will understand the Bible better. And that's what we're all about, doing here Saturday mornings. Okay, there's a number of other things. I will just give you... Actually, we'll skip them. No, I'll mention one or two more. There are certain recurring motifs. For example, the negation of primogeniture, the idea that the firstborn should have the blessing, over and over and over, even though that's the assumption that that's the way things should be, over and over again, the narration of the stories in Genesis and elsewhere shows that it's actually the second child, or the fourth child, or in David's case, the last child who gets it. So there's a number of recurring motifs that come back to the stories, and that's supposed to help you to understand how a story is being told. Another one would be the motif of an infertile woman who becomes pregnant because of the visitation of a person, a prophet, of a messenger of God in a more divine sense, etc. We could go on and on. I'll give one last mini example, other instance of a type of biblical literary style that's different than ours before going on to the main one that we're going to look at for the rest of the morning. And that's simply the idea of keywords. Sometimes in a story you'll get a key word or words that recur. And by this repetition, it slowly should dawn on the reader that this is the central idea of this narrative episode. For example, in 1 Samuel 15. Let's take a real quick look at it. 1 Samuel 15. It's interesting, the opening line of it. Maybe, Bill, do you want to read the opening line of 1 Samuel 15?
I'll have to borrow some verses. Samuel said to Saul, "I am the one the Lord sent to anoint you king over his people Israel. So listen now to the message from the Lord."
Now it's actually, "V'ata shema l'kod divrei Adonai." So we have both the verb to listen and the word for voice or kod here. And these two words recur over and over and over in the story. You know the story. It's better to... obedience is better than sacrifice, right? Listening to the voice of God is better than... Let's read that line in 22. Can someone read that sort of... this is the epitome of the entire story here, this line that summarizes things in 22.
The Lord is great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices, and as in obeying the voice of the Lord. Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than that the fat of rams.
Now in English we lose it, because the word there for obey is simply to listen, which has the sense of obey. Right. That's right. And so you miss that in English. I'm sorry if you don't have an either literal translation like the King James, or if you don't know Hebrew yourself, you'll miss those types of details. You'll miss it, but they're important. They're subtle, but that's exactly the style of the biblical author. And you can notice that whole idea of hearing comes through not just in the beginning and this and the climax of the episode, but also, for example, in verse 19. You know, what is that bleating I hear in my ears? Right? Oh, I'm sorry. Where's the bleating? Is verse 14. Vayomer Shmuel, ume kol hatzon hazeh ba'oznayim. Right? So the idea of the words kol and shama appear over and over. Now we're going to get to the last, I mean, there may be many more aspects of narrative, biblical narrative style that we haven't looked at, but the one that I want to look at today, and the last one I'll mention, and that we'll focus on, is the idea of stylizing a particular episode on a previous episode that happens in the Bible, or more importantly, for our purposes today, stylizing a particular individual on the portrayal of an earlier individual or a different individual in the narrative. I'll give you an example of episode to episode. We looked at this last week or the week before. You have in Leviticus 9:24, where the temple is dedicated, the altar is dedicated, fire comes down and consumes the sacrifice on the altar. The people see it, they shout out something, they fall down. That's Leviticus 9:24. And if you go to 2 Chronicles 7, 1 through 3, where Solomon's temple is dedicated, so this is, you had the tabernacle, now you have the temple, the same thing happens, fire comes down. Actually, in Leviticus, fire comes out from Milifnei Adonai, and here it comes down from heaven, in 2 Chronicles 7, 1 through 3. But the people do the same thing, they see it, they...
לכל בני ישראל רואים ברדת האש וכבוד אדוני על הבית ויכרעו הפנים ארצה על הרצפה ויכתחבו והודות לאדוני כי טוב כי לעולם חסדו.
Amen. So they fall down and they bow on their faces and they say the Lord is good and his loving kindness endures forever. It's the same thing. I mean, this is the way it makes sense to tell that story in the same way that you told the other story, because in the one you have the dedication of the tabernacle, now you have the dedication of the temple of Solomon. So it makes sense to read.
What verse was it on that?
2 Chronicles 7, 1 through 3.
Only one point.
Sure.
Nothing to do with the temple. The Hebrew here is totally different. This is what I call exilic Hebrew.
Sure. Yeah, later period, for sure. And incidentally, you can tell that story without the detail of the fire, because it happens in 1 Kings. In 1 Kings, where they tell the story of the dedication of the tabernacle of Solomon, the glory of the Lord comes, but you don't hear anything about fire. I won't comment on that right now or today at all, but let's go on to the idea of, and this is what will occupy our time now, the idea of stylizing the story of an individual in general in light of the story of another individual, usually somebody who is chronologically prior in terms of the biblical chronology. Again, a lot of this is very subtle, and that word subtlety for me summarizes the biblical style for narrative. Let's skip Adam and Eve. Let's go to the next major character in Genesis. And let's go to Noah. Let's talk about the story of Noah. And if you think about Noah, who do you think is most like Noah later on in the Bible? You can give me your thoughts, and if you disagree with me, then I'll give you my thoughts, and then we'll leave it at that. But
I've never thought about it before the question, but I thought of Moses.
Tell me why.
Well, because in the same way that a small group of a larger whole is saved through water, you've got this image where Moses brings the people of Israel out of Egypt, and there's this passing through the Red Sea, which is a salvation, and both of them are sort of a baptism of it as well.
I like it. I've never thought of it in quite that way, in terms of, I've thought of those two events together, but I've never thought of putting the two people together. I like it. I'm going to think about it more. The person that I thought of was Lot, and I'll give you my reasons for it. You could on your own, first of all, say maybe he's more like Enoch, because if you look at 6:9, it says that what does it say in 6:9? Can somebody read that for me?
Hail to Lot Noah.
Yeah.
Noah is tzadik tamim haya bedvarotav et ha'elohim hitalech Noah. Exactly the same as Hanoch.
Exactly. So he walks with God, which is the same as Noah, as Hanoch, Enoch. Abraham walks before God, but both Lot and Noah walk with God. So you might have paired them up together. You might have paired him up with Abraham. Not sure what that is.
It's
the alarm. Okay, that's strange. But or Moses, and this is nice. But I think overall, Lot is the best candidate, and I'm going to stick with Lot. But even the Tower of Babel story is not bad. The Tower of Babel story, what happens there? It's not an individual. Again, we're not pairing up individuals in this case. It's just episodes. But in this story, why did I say the Tower of Babel story? I don't remember. We'll leave that. I didn't have enough thoughts. I didn't have enough notes written down for myself. We'll just skip that. Anyways, we don't have that much time anyway, so we'll skip it. Let's go with the Lot one. Why Lot? In 6 verse 9, we just heard that Noah is tzaddik. Right? You also get that in 7 verse 1. Someone want to read that as well.
And the Lord said to Noah, "Enter the ark, you and all your household, for you alone I have seen to be righteous before me in this time."
Okay? We don't get a lot of people being described as tzaddik. It doesn't happen a lot. But where that especially not in Genesis, but where that comes up, tzaddik, is in the story of Lot. Abraham argues with God. If there's one righteous person, or sorry, if there's, what do we start with, 50 or do we start with 40?
Starts with 50.
Starts with 50.
Ends with 10.
Ends with 10. If there's 50, if there's 40. But the idea of finding the tzaddikim in Sodom, in Sodom, is an important theme, and it ties the idea of saving a righteous person out of a wicked situation, a wicked generation. That's one connection. Another connection is the use of the verb to wipe out, which is l'hashchit. If you take a look in the beginning of chapter 6 here, verse 5, Genesis 6:5, through to where is it here? No, here he's actually, this is a good point as well. He starts with the verb macha, to wipe out. That's in verse 6 verse 7. But later, the returning of this verb lashchit happens quite a few times. Thank you. Take a look, for example, in verse 11 and 12. Can somebody read verse 11 and 12 in chapter 6?
"Now the earth was corrupt in God's sight and was full of violence. God saw how corrupt the earth had become, for all the people on earth had corrupted their ways."
And one more verse.
"So God said to Noah, I'm going to put an end to all people, for the earth is filled with violence because of them. I'm sure you're going to destroy both them and the earth."
So the verb there for wiping out is lashchit, like I was saying. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to do a quick search because I didn't write down all the references, but it happens a number of times in chapter 6, verse 12, 13, the related verb, in a number of places also. It also appears in our story in with Lot. Take a look in chapter 18. Let's start with verse 28. In verse 18. In chapter 18, rather.
"Ulai yachzerun chamishim hatzadikim chamisha. Hatashchit b'chamisha et kol ha'ir."
Right, and so the verb there is again tashchit. Now you might think, well, maybe that's a common verb that's used for wiping out or destroying. But we already saw in the beginning of chapter 6 that you could use the verb macha, which is to wipe out. And that the verb l'hashchit does not appear in, for example, Genesis 11 with the story of Babel. No one gets killed there, they get spread out. But also if you think of chapter 20, where you have Abimelech, I believe, right? Abraham goes down there.
Yeah.
It could, there could be, you might expect in a story like this where you would get a threat that I'm going to wipe out your people. But that verb also doesn't appear there. It appears in these two stories, in the Lot story and the Noah story.
May I point out that in 20 verse 13, no translation will tell you what it says in the Hebrew. The point made in the Hebrew, Vayikra Asher Hit'u Oti. Not Hit'a.
Sure, that the gods have deceived us.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Other things, you tell me, what are other parts of these two stories that connect them? I've given you two words, tzaddik and leashchit. We're talking about the general story of Lot and the general story of Noah.
Another word, karet, for instance. Karet.
I don't remember those two being both here, but
No, you don't have it then.
Okay. A family is saved. Right? Noah's family is saved, Lot's family is saved. What else? An elemental force wipes out civilization or part of civilization. What else? There's some
drunkenness at the end of the stories too.
There's drunkenness at the end of stories. There's also some form of sexual deviance at the end of both stories.
Yeah.
You may say, maybe not with Noah, well, he was naked. We're not sure exactly what was going on there, but there may well have been some form of sexual deviance that was taking place there. Certainly there was drunkenness, like in both stories. What else? The nations that descend from the children of that family that saved the children that descend from those descendants. The children that descend from the children that are saved in these two stories become nations. Right?
Yeah.
And what's another aspect that ties these two people's life stories together? Also, the destruction in both cases is foretold by God. Now, often when we have two episodes that are tied together in the Bible or two life stories that are tied together, it's actually the differences that point out to us what the point is that's trying to be made. And if we look at these two, what are the differences that we see between the story of Noah and the story of Lot? Yeah, absolutely. Lot's wife doesn't make it. Noah's wife does. Lot's children's spouses don't make it. Noah's children's spouses do. Three make it out with Lot. Eight make it out with Noah. So that's already telling you something about the situation there.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you could say Noah's flood is global. Lot's catastrophe is local. You could say that. But there's something else that's going on. I mean, that is a point. But in our story with Lot, the destruction is not foretold to Lot, but it's foretold to Abraham, and Abraham is the one who intercedes. In the story with Noah, the destruction is foretold to Noah, and nobody needs to intercede. There's a different type of dynamic that's going on in those two stories. Also, if you think about the descendants, who are the descendants of Noah? Everybody, the good and the bad. Who are the descendants of Lot? Those bad guys over there across the Jordan, for the most part, right? We don't really think of the Moabites. You get Ruth. You get some others. But the Moabites and the Ammonites, who are the descendants of Lot, are not the good guys. These stories end up in a different direction. And are we the only people that are? Am I the only person that's forcing people to read Noah and Lot stories together? No, actually, if you go to, for example, Luke 17, 2 through 28, take a look at Luke 17, 2 through 28. Jesus read the two stories together, and he wasn't the only one. These are two stories that work together. They're meant to be tied together. You're meant to think about them in the same breath. We don't have to read the whole thing, but if you can see in Luke 17, 2 through 28, it says, woe, it will be like in the days of Noah. Woe, it will be like in the days of Lot. They're both together. We're not going to read the whole thing. But take a look also at 2 Peter 2. 2 Peter 2, 5 through 9. Peter, here is doing something very similar to what Jesus does, which doesn't surprise us if the followers of Jesus have the same type of way of thinking about the scriptures. He also ties in Noah and Lot. And now read his description. Actually, this, can somebody read 5 through 9? This would be good to hear.
If he did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah, a herald of righteousness, with seven others, when he brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly, if by turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to ashes he condemned them to extinction, making them an example of what is going to happen to the ungodly, and if he rescued righteous Lot, greatly distressed by the sensual conduct of the wicked, for as that righteous man lived among them day after day, he was tormenting his righteous soul over their lawless deeds that he saw and heard, then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from trials and to keep the unrighteous under punishment until the day of judgment.
So take a look at how this author pulls things together. It's interesting. The clear point of both of those stories, which is the same, is that there's destruction for the wicked and God can save the righteous. And the righteous, he picks up on the word righteous. These are one of the words that ties the two stories together.
Is Lot called righteous in Genesis?
No, it's the implication from this argument. If there's 10 righteous people and they end up with 3 that make it. But there's something else in the way that Peter here gives the comparison of these two stories. See if you can see what the difference is that is also hinted at.
George, I don't know if this is anywhere where you're going, but it's a difference that I think is there, is in Lot's case, then righteousness was invading his home, coming into his home. In Noah's, I don't know if we know that. It seemed a little different in that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where they were trying to come into his home, his place of hospitality, his place of protection.
I like the point. It's not the point that Peter's making. I like the point, and it's connected to that is the idea that there are two divine beings that come in to help out in Lot's case, whereas in Noah's case, he doesn't get that extra help because it's not something that's invading him, and he doesn't need this personal type of protection.
You do see a little bit in Peter.
Okay, go for it. Maybe I missed it.
No, not necessarily a direct connection, but how he was tormented.
Right, know? Absolutely.
You know, so you see a little of that.
If you look at verse 5, it says, Noah, a preacher of righteousness. Noah dikos sunes keduka. That's in the Greek. And if you look at how does it describe Lot?
Lot a
righteous man. Ke dikion lot. The difference here is you have a preacher of righteousness and a righteous man. And I think that Peter has subtly picked up on the difference, or has picked up on the subtle difference between the two stories. In the one story, Noah is able to talk to his family members and get them to come along with him, and he's able to even bring his in-laws with him. In Lot's case, he wasn't preaching righteousness, is how this person is reading those two stories together, and he was only able to bring 3 people with him. For us, that's a warning to speak when we know that something is unjust, and to try to help people along to do the right thing. That's how one person is reading those two stories together, and I like it. Let's go on. We're going to skip the patriarchs. We could have some fun saying who is Abraham most like. I think we'd end up with Jacob, and I think Isaac is kind of a person that sort of sits off on the side, even though all 3 of them, of course, are somewhat similar. But let's skip them because it's not going to push us where we want to go in the next 20 minutes. We're going to go now to Moses. When we think about Moses, and here we might have a couple of answers. Who is most like Moses in the Bible?
Jesus.
Let's stick to the Hebrew Bible first. Okay. In the Hebrew Bible, who is most like Moses?
Joshua?
Yeah, maybe Joshua. Why? You tell me how are the stories told that tie them together?
Well, you have the repetition of some of the same motives or actions where you begin the Red Sea and then Moses leads, he dies, and then Joshua takes the people as leader, and then there's another passage through the Jordan River.
Absolutely. So they both take the people of God through a body of water. And actually, on exactly that point, which I think we looked at a couple, either last week or the week before, in Numbers, or sorry, not Numbers, in Joshua 3 and 4, it says at the very beginning, God says, I'm going to do these things so that they will fear you just like they feared Moses. And at the ending, it says, of that episode of crossing the Jordan, it says the same thing. Yeah, maybe it's worth taking a look at real quick. Take a look at 3 verse 7, is the opening of that episode, and then 4:14. Can somebody read 3 verse 7? Joshua?
The Lord said to Joshua, today I will begin to exalt you in the sight of all Israel, that they may know that as I was with Moses, so I will be with you.
So that's a fairly, that's not even subtle, that's just in your face. This is a parallel between Moses and Joshua. Take a look at 4:14. Anybody?
The Lord exalted Joshua in the sight of all Israel, and they revered him all the days of his life, just as they had revered Moses.
There you go. So this is sort of an inclusio at the beginning and the ending of that episode, and it tells us explicitly that these people are to be paired together, and that Joshua is every bit as good as Moses. But there's some more subtle things too, or perhaps less subtle, because the stories are so... they're very powerful stories. They're very explicit stories in terms of either God's actions or the actions of the entire people. Can you think of other stories of Joshua and Moses that tie them together? I'll give you a hint. Moses is called, chapter 3. What happens? Exodus chapter 3. You tell me. What does he see? Where is he?
Burning bush.
He sees a burning bush? What does God say? Take off your shoes. Thank you. Take a look at Joshua 3. Who appears to Joshua before their first major event in conquering the land of Canaan? What happens there? I'm sorry, chapter 5. Did I say 3? I meant 5. 5:13. Anybody can read that?
Now it came about when Joshua was by Jericho that he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a man was standing opposite him with his sword drawn in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said to him, are you for us or are you for our adversaries? And he said, no, rather I indeed come now as captain of the host of the Lord. And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and bowed down and said to him, what has my Lord to say to his servant? And the captain of the Lord's host said to Joshua, remove your sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy. And Joshua did so.
Great. There's only two places in the entire Hebrew Bible where you have take off your shoes. And actually the words shal na'alecha is in both places. Yeah. So I mean, the sensitive reader or the reader that's just familiar with the text actually will be hit in the face with that parallel there. And it's saying, just like God appeared to Moses and called Moses, God appeared to Joshua and called Joshua. There's one more in the Moses-Joshua parallel that I'd like to bring out, but maybe you guys can read my mind or you can think of something else important that happens with Moses that also happens with Joshua. Think of the very end of the book of Joshua as a hint. And this is, again, the kind of thing that would actually probably hit you in the face if you'd spent a lot of time reading the book of Exodus, a lot of time familiar with these stories, and you read the end of Joshua,
gathers all the people together.
He gathers all the people together for sure, but a lot of people do that in the Hebrew Bible. give me some more specifics here. Okay, well, I'll push my agenda a little bit here. Take a look. First of all, he gives them a parting speech, like Moses does. That's like in Deuteronomy. But also, more than that, take a look at verse chapter 24, around the end, 24. What do the people say in response to Joshua? Say, "Vayomeru ha'am el Yoshua et Adonai Eloheinu na'avod uvekolo nishma." What is that? We will serve God and we will obey His voice. Where does that bring you? To me, that brings me to Exodus 24. Yeah, when they receive the Torah, they say, "Naaseh v'nishma." Right. This is verse 7 here. And whoa, there's something else here that stops, hits us when we read Exodus 24:7. It says, "Vayikach sefer habrit." So Moses takes a book of the covenant, and actually in Joshua 24, 25, we have "Vayichot Yoshua brit la'am vayomahu vayasam lo chok u'mishpat b'shchem vayichtov Yoshua et ha'divrim ha'ele b'sefer Torat Elohim." So Joshua also writes a book of the Torat Elohim. You've got fairly clear parallels here that this is almost a second giving of the Torah in a sense. They say "Naaseh v'nishma." But in other words, they say now "Et Adonai Eloheinu na'avod uvekolo nishma." But it's very similar. Someone who is sensitive or has familiar with Exodus 24 can't miss that type of parallel. Moses and Joshua are clearly put together. Who else is like Moses? Definitely more than one person here. I mean, you could say Ezra because you have a second giving of the. But there's somebody that's even closer than Ezra. Somebody kind of like Joshua in a way. But different. And the differences are really what makes the story so informative. And
are you thinking of Elijah?
I'm thinking of Elijah. Tell me why. Why is Elijah like Moses?
There's the connection of place when he goes to Mount Horeb and God.
There's only two people that go to Horeb. Yeah, exactly. Moses and Elijah.
And Horeb is not Mount Carmel. Mm-hmm.
And what else? What else bring these two stories together? These two lives together? Who gets bread and meat in the wilderness during a famine?
Elijah.
Mm-hmm. He gets brought to him by ravens, but no big deal. It's the same thing. In Exodus 15 and 16 and 17, no, 15 and 16 rather, they get bread and meat, different kind of meat, but they get it in the wilderness. What else ties these two stories together, these two life stories together? I'll give you one more. On his way to Horeb to meet with God at that mountain, who meets with Moses and what does he receive on the way? An angel appears to him, and what does the angel give him? Exodus 9, or sorry, 1 Kings 19. Take a look, 1 Kings 19. Yeah, what kind of food?
Superfood.
What's that?
Superfood.
Superfood.
Elijah
what?
Or Moses here?
Yeah. 1 Kings 19.
Okay.
1 Kings 19, take a look at verse 6. Yeah, he gets some bread and some water. That sounds like to me like I was wandering in the desert and I needed bread and water. And I got that water from Moses and I got that bread from Moses. Wait a second, Jordash. Bread and water are so common. What are you talking about? Come on, man. You're pushing it. How long does he have to go before he gets to Horeb? 40 days. I mean, there's something being told here. When he gets to Horeb, where does he go? He goes to the cave. What is the cave? Why does Elijah go to the cave? What is the cave? He goes to the cave that Moses went to. This is telling the same story, and these stories are, you have to read them. If you don't read them together, you'll miss the entire point of this story. What is the point of this story? Before we get there, let's talk about something else that Elijah does, that Moses does as well. I'll give you one more. Here, in 19:13, he covers his face. You know how Moses, God turns Moses and covers him with his hand so that he won't see him? Here, Elijah covers his face, but the idea is the same thing. Yeah, details are slightly dissimilar, but there's enough similarity that the sensitive reader is going to pick up on all that and go, wait a second. How do we get Elijah to Mount Horeb? What happens in the story before this?
The confrontation on Carmel.
Yeah, the confrontation on Carmel, and what happens there?
There's fire.
Wow. The people say, Adonai hu Elohim, right? God, He is the Lord, He is God. They decide to follow. What does Elijah do after that? He slaughters all these prophets of Baal. He just slaughters them, lines them up, and kills them all. Bloody guy. And then he gets scared and he runs away. What is the differences? What are the differences in Moses' encounter with God at Horeb and Moses'? Did I just say that? Elijah's and Moses'. You tell me, what are the differences now? That's the meaty stuff. I'll start us off. I'll help out with one point here. If you look at 19 verse 3, on his way to Horeb, what does Elijah do? Yeah, he leaves his servant in Beersheba. We don't know much about the servant. We haven't heard almost anything about him. He kind of pops out of nowhere. Why? Why does this detail come? I think the detail is there to let us know, who does Moses... Does Moses go on his own, or does he take someone with him when he goes up on top of the mountain?
Only possibly.
He takes Joshua part way. There is a story earlier where he takes the 70 elders and Aaron up, and they all see God and eat and drink in front of them. But even with Joshua, he takes him part way. Elijah goes to Horeb completely on his own. Who gets bread and water in the desert? Elijah. When he gets to Mount Horeb, what does he say? God says, what are you doing here, Elijah? And what does he say? Somebody read this is an important sentence, or a couple sentences from Elijah's mouth.
Verse 10, he replied, I've been very zealous for the Lord, O God Almighty. The Israelites have rejected your covenant, broken down your altars, and put your prophets to death with the sword. I'm the only one left, and now they are trying to kill me too.
Now we know better than this, right? We know the story already. How many prophets are, at least how many prophets are already alive that we know of? We know of at least 100 already, right? Obadiahu saved 50 in two different caves. 50 in this cave, 50 in that cave. We know of at least 100 that are alive. So what is Elijah doing saying this? He's saying that they put all the other prophets of God to death. That's not true. We know that. He knows that. The reader knows that. What else do we know in his response here that sounds fishy? Think about it in comparison to what does Moses do when he goes to meet God on the mountain? How does Moses talk to God in Exodus? And how is that different from what Elijah is doing? Does Moses go over there and go, man, those Israelites, they're worshiping the false calf, God nuke them? He argues for the Israelites. He knows that they're in idolatry, but he's saying, wipe me out. If you want to wipe out anyone, wipe me out. But Elijah's not saying that at all. He's saying everybody's abandoned you, which isn't true in the first place. He's saying, I'm the only one left, which isn't true. And he's complaining about them, which is exactly the thing that over and over in Numbers or in elsewhere, the Israelites are get so much trouble for complaining to God about God not being there. And he's at Mount Horeb facing God and complaining and doing exactly what people do when they're disobedient. And then what happens? Somebody read the story of the appearance of God's power and then also God's spoken word. It'd be nice to hear from more women too. We haven't heard enough women voices speaking and reading and sharing.
Where are we exactly?
Where we were in verse chapter 19 and we're on verse 11.
Go out and stand on the mountain in the presence of the Lord, for the Lord is about to pass by. Then a great and powerful wind tore the mountains apart and shattered the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. After the wind there was an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. After the earthquake came the fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire came a gentle whisper. When Elijah heard it, he pulled his cloak over his face and went out and stood at the mouth of the cave.
Keep going. You're doing great.
Then a voice said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He replied, "I have been very zealous for the Lord God Almighty. The Israelites have rejected your covenant, broke down your altars, and put your prophets to death with the sword. I am the only one left, and now they are trying to kill me too." The Lord said to him, "Go back the way you came and go to the desert of Damascus."
That's good. We'll go dot, dot, dot at that point. He gives us some instructions to anoint this person, anoint that person, anoint that person. Two kings and a prophet. One, Elisha is supposed to be after him as the next prophet. The question that God asks is identical to the question he asked before the appearance of fire, the earthquake, and the kol demama daka, the still small voice. And the answer, Elijah's answer in Hebrew is verbatim, the same answer. Nothing changed in his mind after all this demonstration of God's power and God's speaking to him. If you get a verbatim answer with nothing changed, this is telling you something. For one, the Bible narrative is very laconic and terse. The biblical narrator could have just said, Elijah responded saying the same thing. But he doesn't. He takes the time to go word for word. Everything is exactly the same. What are we supposed to be hearing out of this story?
His mind had not been changed.
Absolutely. Absolutely. His mind had not been changed. He still thinks, I'm going to complain about these people. I'm the only one left. And he's not the only one left. And the narrator knows that. The reader knows that. And then what does God say at the end? Okay, go your way. I want you to do these three things and appoint your successor. Basically, in a sense, you're fired. I mean, you might, maybe that's too strong. Maybe you don't like that. Maybe you thought Elijah was a super nice guy. And there's some great things about Elijah. And this is a nice thing about the biblical narratives. You see all the dirty stuff. You see the dirty stuff about David, if you read Kings, or Samuel and Kings anyways. Not so much in Chronicles. But you see here real problems in Elijah's. He has an encounter with God that some of us would dream of, and he doesn't get it. And God's like, okay, I got a few more tasks for you, and then where someone else is going to come up right after you and follow your... Now, we don't have time to go into all of this, and we have, like, say, if we push it, we have maybe 7-10 minutes left, something like that. Depends if we go downstairs late. But what I wanted to do after all of this is to go back to Jesus, go back to what we were talking about the last 2 weeks. In summary, Jesus, in terms of the miracles that he does, is most like Elijah and Elisha. Why? He multiplies bread. This is something Elisha does in 2 Kings. He raises dead children of families back to them, both like Elijah and like Elisha. What are some of the other things that we mentioned? He meets the needs of individuals rather than... It's not... In the minor miracles of Elijah and Elisha's stories, he's not meeting the needs. These prophets are not meeting the needs of the entire nation at times. The individual, for example, healing the leprosy of Naaman, this is not something that brings unity to the entire nation. He does this for an individual. Yeah, it has a political, socio-political aspect to it.
The widow of Shaphat.
Or the widow, or the Shunammite woman, or he's helping people out in their personal needs. And this is what Jesus is like. On the other hand, there are things that Jesus does that bring him in a way kind of like Moses. It's not that Herod or Pilate or the leaders of the government show up. It's not that necessarily the priestly leaders show up and follow and are part of some kind of covenant renewing ceremony like with Elijah on Mount Carmel. However, he does have 12 disciples, which are symbolic of the entire nation. He does feed people in the wilderness, in a deserted place, Eremos, in Greek. And that's with the feeding of the 5,000 intervention is in all four of the Gospels. It seems to be a very important story for all of the Gospel. And in John, it's clear that...
Nina.
In John, it's clear that... this is being connected with Moses feeding the people, because right smack dab in the middle of this story and then the meeting him, he goes out and walks on the water in John. Walking on the water, having control of the water, this is the same thing that Moses, Joshua, Elijah, and Elisha all had, and Jesus does that. Now, when we get to the other thing, where Jesus goes up onto a mountain, and he brings three disciples with him, and there is a kind of, there's some appearance of glory up there, and who appears up there with him? Moses and Elijah. You're being pulled back to 1 Kings 19 and the Exodus story of Moses on Mount Sinai. But again, it's the differences that make this story, that give it its power. And a sensitive reader in the first century or whatever century of late antiquity that's reading these stories and familiar with the Hebrew Bible or the Hebrew Bible in translation in Greek is going to go, wait a second, what is being said by this story? I think the Transfiguration story is actually one of the key stories. Where does it happen in the narration of, let's say, the Synoptic Gospels? At what point does it come in? You remember they go up to Caesarea Philippi and Jesus saying, "What? Who do people say that I am? Some say you're this, some say you're that.
But who do you say?
Who do you say that I am?" And the Christ, the Son of God, the Messiah, the Son of the Living God. And he's like, okay, keep that, you know, hush, hush. By the way, the Messiah has to be beaten and slaughtered, etc. And they're like, oh, whoa. And then shortly after, we have the story of the Transfiguration on the mountain. You tell me, think about Moses, think about Elijah, and tell me what the difference is with this story of the Transfiguration. I guess we better read it. No, we don't have time. We don't have time. You have to read it on your own. You have to just trust me. But let's try to remember the details of that story. What happens on this mountain?
Peter wants to rebuild build tabernacles.
He wants to build three tabernacles there to those three individuals.
Significant, maybe in contrast, that Peter and the other guys are even there.
Bingo! Mm-hmm. Jesus brings up three people. Elijah is on his own. Moses comes with 70, with the elders at one point. On another point, he goes on his own. But Moses, certainly, it's a national event. Everybody is standing at the mountain looking up at the fire. They're there. They're aware. No one else is aware of what's going on with Elijah. And only three people actually know what is going on with Jesus. And he tells them to be quiet about it. Big difference. All three of those stories have a very different way in who's there and who sees what. What else happens in Jesus' case, which is different? Elijah does not get affirmed by God. We could at least say that much, right? Does Jesus get affirmed?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, big time. He says, "This is my son, listen to him." And the other two disappear, and the implication is that somehow Jesus is much more important than Moses and Elijah. There's some other important details, and we have 2 minutes left. If you can help me out, we'll get to the end of this study. I know it's not fair if we haven't read the text. I know it's not fair. And you're trying to read my mind. That's even worse. Moses goes up on the mountain. Who does he see? God. Elijah goes up on the mountain. Who does he see?
He doesn't.
He sees power of God and he hears God's voice. But that's it. When Jesus and the three first go up on the mountain, who do they see? Elijah, Moses, and Jesus transformed and shining brightly. Moses goes up and sees God, and therefore he shines. Jesus and these three go up, and Jesus shines, and he hasn't seen anybody.
Because he is.
The people that are telling this story, remembering the story, and telling the story are giving these details in such a way that you will go, wait a second, Jesus is shining, he hasn't seen anything, what is happening here? I would say it's, Joe would use the word strongly suggestive, that this is strongly suggestive of the fact that the early believers that are telling this story are seeing Jesus as something beyond human. And I think that's true. And I want to sum up with this point that there are people that argue that the Gospel of Mark, first of all, they argue that the Gospel of Mark is the earliest. And second of all, they argue from the fact or the assumption that it's the earliest that the earliest believers in Jesus did not see Jesus as anything more than the Davidic Messiah. Why do they say that? They say that because you don't have the birth narratives like you have in Matthew and Luke, which are later additions, they would say, to make Jesus look more divine, have divine origin from a virgin birth. And that in the case of Mark, when Jesus goes to get baptized at the beginning, a voice says, "This is my son, whom I have chosen, or in whom I love." I don't remember exactly the wording, I'm sorry. But they would argue that this is an adoption of a Messiah, that presumably God could have adopted any Davidic descendant as his Messiah, but he chose this one in particular, and therefore Jesus is just a human like anyone else, but was chosen for this thing. I think these people that are reading Mark in this way, first of all, I don't agree that Mark was the earliest gospel. I think that there was something else written in Hebrew earlier, and there's evidence for that. I'm not the person.
That is evidence.
And it's not the place to do it here, but certainly Randall Booth and others could do it a much better job, David Bibbin. But also, even if you take Mark as the earliest, and you read the story of the Transfiguration, you read it with first century ears that are familiar with the Hebrew Bible, you come away with this, you cannot come away saying he's just slightly more than Moses or Elijah. You come away with this saying he is far greater than any character in the Hebrew Bible, according to these stories. And also, he's shining on his own. There is something beyond human going on here with Jesus. And I think, to be honest with the sources, you may disagree. You may say that Jesus isn't divine. That's a different issue. But to argue that Mark doesn't claim that, I think, is really problematic and can't be. It's not tenable.
If he isn't divine, then the whole story doesn't make any sense.
I would agree. So thank you guys. Shabbat Shalom.
I do not regret.